And welcome to this week's special St. Patrick's Day program of Talking History. My name is Robert Hopkins of Creighton University's Department of History, and I'll be your host for today's program, sitting in for Brian LeBeau. Looking back at this week, March 9th through 15th in history, we recall that on March 9th, 1954, CBS newsman Edward R. Murrow took on Senator Joseph R. McCarthy, a leading anti-communist, on Murrow's news show, See It Now. By the end of the year, McCarthy was viewed as a disgrace by his peers for his actions in conjunction with the House Un-American Activities Committee. Murrow's show receives much of the credit for aligning the American public against McCarthy. On 10 March 1876, Alexander Graham Bell placed history's first telephone call, but it wasn't exactly long distance. Bell's assistant, Watson, answered the call from the room next door. On 13 March 1884, Standard Time was adopted across the United States. The move to standardize U.S. time zones actually came not from the government, but from private railroad companies who needed such regulations in order to establish timetables. On 14 March 1794, Eli Whitney received a patent for the device that would prolong the institution of slavery, the cotton gin. And finally, on 15 March 44 BC, Julius Caesar was stabbed in the back by a group of old friends and fellow politicians, including Brutus and Cassius, who had conspired to assassinate him on the Ides of March. And turning to history in the news, three scientists lost in the thick of Peru's Amazon jungle claim to have discovered a pre-Incan stone city. While filming a documentary on the 4,000-year-old neighboring Gran Pajatan ruins, the scientists wandered off to explore an unknown stretch of virgin forest. What they found were chunks of gold and a city they describe as both larger and more imposing than the famed Gran Pajatan. And while archaeologists dig through jungle dirt for clues about mysterious cities, American historians are sifting through dirt of another kind. Recently released transcripts from the Watergate era showed that former President Richard Nixon initially considered destroying the tapes which forced his resignation in 1974. The recordings, which have been in the custody of the National Archives for two decades, reveal the president's alarm over the potential dangers of the tape and the revelation of his guilt. They present a more detailed account of the president's political maneuvering between the spring of 1973 and the climax of the scandal in summer of 1974. And finally, British Prime Minister Tony Blair has reopened investigations into the 1972 Bloody Sunday killings in Londonderry, Northern Ireland. The notorious incident in which British paratroopers shot and killed 14 unarmed civil rights marchers set off an explosion of hatred and hostilities between opponents and supporters of British rule. The original investigation exonerated British soldiers and placed blame squarely with the protesters. In recognizing St. Patrick's Day, our principal interview this week uncovers a little-known link between Irish immigrants and America's expansion to a continental power. If you ask people today about America's wars during the middle of the 1800s, nearly everyone remembers the Civil War beginning in 1861, but few recall a war some 15 years earlier that gave most Civil War military leaders their first taste of battle and command. The Mexican-American War of 1846 through 1848 is largely attributed to resolving the issue of Texan sovereignty and American desire for territory, but it took place during a time of considerable ideological controversy within the United States. Slavery, manifest destiny, and a rising nativist movement all colored people's visions of the war. This contributed to the wholesale desertion of many U.S.-Irish Catholic soldiers into the St. Patrick's Battalion, known as the San Patricios, to fight for Mexico. Their story is a fascinating tale of American identity in the 1800s. Our guest today is Peter F. Stevens, the award-winning author of a new book on the San Patricios, The Rogue's March, to be published in May by Brassey's. Mr. Stevens' previous publications include The Mayflower Murderer and Other Forgotten Firsts in American History, and numerous articles in prestigious journals, magazines, and newspapers around the country. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what can you tell us about the Mexican-American War? How can our listeners get a quick update and summary of what this was all about?
Well, the issues are very complex, and they basically break down into two schools of thought And just briefly, it's a lot of people view it as more or less the logical conclusion of manifest destiny. The U.S. was going to spread across the continent no matter who got in the way. And there's also the matter of the disputed border with Mexico and Texas, which obviously went back to the Texan War of Independence. And there was a great deal of argument as to where Texas ended and Mexico began.
So this was not only about territory, but also the ideology associated with that territory, whether or not it would be slave-oriented, non-slave-oriented. So there was a lot of ideology mixed in with this.
Yes, it were. There was an awful lot of ideology mixed in. As I said, it's a very, very complex issue, the causes of the war. And again, people do fall into the two schools of thought.
All right. And that manifest destiny idea, was that inculcated with any kind of American virtuosity or preference for religion, individual behavior, that sort of thing?
Well, a lot of people believe it is very, very much steeped in Calvinism and the sort of Anglo-Puritan ethic that was more or less responsible for having settled America and spread westward. Mexico certainly views it this way, and a lot of people do see it as almost messianic in some respects, a form of Anglo-American Protestantism overspreading the continent.
Right, and that was part of the American culture, the environment at the time, really, what, due to the incidental growth of revivalism in the 30s and things?
Yeah, there was a huge rise in that, which eventually led to nativism, which was an anti-Catholic, anti-immigrant movement. Ironically enough, one of the men who got the ball rolling, so to speak, in that movement was Samuel Morse, the inventor of the telegram. I'm sorry, the telegraph.
Why was nativism necessarily anti-Catholic or anti-Irish?
There are a lot of reasons. In the 1830s, we began to get increased Irish immigration to this country, certainly not on the levels that would come in the 1840s once the famine struck Ireland, but certainly a steadily escalating influx, a rising tide, if you will, of Irish immigration. And in the 1840s, we also began to get more and more Germans literally in the same boat. And a lot of American Protestants felt very threatened by this because of centuries-old religious prejudices from the old world that was obviously brought here, transplanted here. And they were kind of viewing the Irish as more or less the first wave of papal aggression in this country. It sounds crazy by our standards today, but it was a very real concern to them.
So the ideological and certainly the religious situation is going to predispose the events that will take place during the battles of the Mexican-American War.
No question about it, because the U.S. Army, as in almost any era, was a microcosm of the larger issues in society.
What can you tell us about the U.S. Army? Who made up the Army? What were they like? What was their background?
On the eve of the Mexican War, the U.S. Army was very small. It was less than 10,000 effectives, as they say, 10,000 officers and men. And of that, nearly 50% were foreign-born men. They were immigrants who had been in this country, many of them, most of them actually, for only a few years, heavily Irish, but also with many Germans in the mix. And both of them tended to be Catholics, both the Irish and the Germans who had come here at that point.
From your research, you've shown that there were, what, about 5,000 Irish immigrants in the Army at that time?
By the end of the Mexican War, out of the U.S. forces that actually fought, the men who actually fought in Mexico, I believe the figure is roughly 5,300 were Irish. At the beginning of the war, it was even greater.
And within Zachary Taylor's troops, within his regulars, almost half, you found out, were foreign-born, with among those the Irish the dominant. Is that
47% is a generally accepted figure, yes.
Good grief. So, in short, this vision of an American populace being represented within the Army is a little distorted at this time.
Oh, there's no question about it. You have a very volatile mix here.
And General Scott's group, which was one of the ones that had to deal with the San Patricios most
right.
closely, how many of those were foreigners? Was it a large
figures
proportion?
Figures vary. No less than 33%, but some have put it as high as 40%, so it was a lot.
So most of the troops at this time are certainly, as one account put it, either mercenaries or just people who are not necessarily mainstream American.
Very few of them were mainstream Americans. Scott even admitted in his letters that few of the immigrants in his ranks were yet naturalized citizens, which means they had been in the country, obviously, for 7 years or less. So they had very little stake ideologically in the war.
Did they have an inherent allegiance to the United States, or were they, as some have claimed, simple mercenaries who were fighting for whatever money would end up in their pockets?
No, that's been one of the knocks. I mean, that's an oversimplification. There's no question that some of them, John Riley, who would be their field commander. He was an experienced soldier of the British Army, as were many of these men. But many more, even if they were British Army veterans, were immigrants to this country who found themselves at the bottom of the social pecking order, again, if you will. And they joined the Army out of desperation for the $7 a month private's pay, which a lot of Americans absolutely would have turned up their noses at.
So in many ways, this was the only job left in the land of dreams.
No question. No question. When they... as they put it, the Irish used to put it, came to the golden door. They found something considerably less valuable.
Well, one of the people who came to that golden door was John Riley. Or was it John O'Reilly? Or who is this John Riley anyway?
It was all of those. John Riley, he spelled, as is the case with many people of that era, spelled phonetically. And a lot of times he spelled his name Riley. He spelled his name O'Reilly. Variations of Riley with an E-I, an I-E, two L's, one L. He spelled it all of these different ways. A lot of people believe that when he tacked on the O, it was more or less sort of a throwback to the head of the clans in Ireland in ages past with the O.
One of the reasons he claims to have defected to become a deserter, certainly to lead the desertion, as you so properly point out, and quote, is that he did so on the advice of his conscience.
Yes.
How does that reconcile with other assertions that he was a deserter when he was a British soldier?
There is absolutely no evidence that has been uncovered, and this includes my own searches through any number of heavily Irish units in the British Army of the era that John Riley deserted the British Army. As a matter of fact, what we do know is that he had at least become a sergeant or a sergeant major. He'd won his stripes, and he'd won them the hard way, an Irishman coming up through the ranks. That story came from an article that was sort of after the fact, after the executions of some of his men outside Mexico City, and it was from a publication called the Niles Register, in which they said he'd been a member of the 66th Regiment, foot soldiers in the British Army, and had deserted from Canada. The 66th was not even stationed in America, in North America at that time, so that pretty much rules that out.
So in many ways it was just yellow journalism designed either
no
to justify...
No question about it. They were trying to make him fit an image. The one thing, a lot of people have portrayed him as a mercenary. In some respects, you can make a case for this. He did serve as far... Well, we know he served in three armies, obviously. The British Army, the American Army for 7 months and 3 days, as he put it, before he went over the hill, and also the Mexican Army, where he achieved his obvious fame or infamy. The thing about Riley, the one thing that shines through in his letters, and this is something that's been grossly underplayed over the years, is that this man was definitely an Irish nationalist, a very frustrated and bitter Irish nationalist at heart. If I may, could I possibly read just two lines from one of his letters to a man in Michigan?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay.
His words probably better than we could ever hope to.
Well, he does it a lot better than I could. And he is telling this man, a former employer in Michigan, he said... let's see, I want you to understand under what banner we fought so bravely. It was that glorious emblem of our nation's rights, which should have, this is his writing, it's hard to read, which should have floated over our native soil, Ireland, many years ago. It was St. Patrick, the Harp of Erin, the shamrock on a green field, and, okay, then he's saying goodbye. But basically, what you have here is like with many of the Irish who came through O'Connell's more or less peaceful rebellion of the 1830s. It's this very, very frustrated sense of, you know, of nationalism, knowing that they were never going to have control of their own nation, at least not in their lifetime.
So could one argue that perhaps Riley was tilting at windmills and saw this as an opportunity, the desertion, the San Patricios, as perhaps a way either to rebel against an authority in his own land or perhaps establish some kind of Irish home here in the United States?
Well, possibly. A lot of it was Riley, at least. You can definitely make the argument with Riley in a lot of his letters and all. The issue of religion weighs heavily on him. As an Irish Catholic, he saw himself, he quite frankly didn't want to see himself anymore as, in his eyes, soldiering in the term of the time for a Protestant army that was invading a Catholic nation. And he drew parallels in one of his letters to the English subjugation of Ireland and what the United States was doing to Mexico. So in his mind, at least, there were some parallels.
And you show that very strongly in your work. One of the quotes that I found most interesting was from an Irish immigrant artillery private named Mick Ryan,
right,
who tells us about life in the Army. Not only was it harsh, but it was particularly brutal against Catholics, where Ryan says, quote, "If a poor devil wants to ever be religious, it's no use trying it here in the U.S. Army.
Right.
I suppose that's what you call liberty of conscience in this blessed free republic of ours."
Just dripping with sarcasm, obviously, and also a bit of dose of reality for him.
How rough was life in the Army, not only for Catholics, but for anybody? We get this perception today of Army life being the good life, get your education. What was it like in 1845 and 1846?
Completely different. Obviously, anyone who's done time in the military, in our era, there's no question discipline is always going to be strict. No question about that. It was brutal in the 1840s, virtually not. It was more or less a continuation of practices that were established in not just our army, but European armies of the day, but absolutely brutal punishments. The problem in the United States Army at that time was that there were basically two separate codes of justice, one for the so-called native-born American soldier and the other one for the immigrant. They had a much harder time of it. And the field court-martials of the era reflect, actually they prove that two soldiers committing the same offense, one, say, an Irish Catholic or a German Catholic, and the other, a native-born American, the Catholic would receive a much harsher punishment.
So that combines the harshness, the cruelty of military life with the nativism, the manifest destiny, the social and ideological climate of America.
It's the ugly little chaser in all of this. Into that volatile stew, again, of all these other factors. Now, you throw in the unbalanced discipline that was going on in the U.S. Army towards the immigrants here, and it really got a lot of them thinking even more, I believe, about their religion.
Do you think that the San Patricios deserted for religious reasons, for harsh reasons? Or how would you summarize their motivation, other than simple conscience, as Riley says, to leave and fight for the Mexicans?
Mixed. There's no question in my mind that many of them did desert on grounds of conscience. However, I think that conscience, for a lot of them, was definitely prodded by the very, literally savage discipline in the U.S. Army of the time. There were religious concerns, but in some of the trials, it does come across that many of these men did flee, did desert the U.S. Army because of the tough time they were having from their officers there.
What can you tell us about the military accomplishments of the San Patricios? How were they received by the Mexicans, their honor, their glory in battle, if at all? What's their military record like?
Well, the Mexicans, right from the start, welcomed them. The Mexicans look upon them as freedom fighters, in a sense, men who acted on their conscience and joined Mexico's cause against, as the Mexicans see it, the Yankee aggressor, the gringo, again, that term of the era. And It's a little tough to put them all in that same boat. Again, the reasons were really mixed. They were a foreign legion in that sense. I mean, they were made up of heavily Irish, but an awful lot of Germans, and even Americans, native-born Americans, who some of them fleeing the discipline of the American Army, they actually took up arms against their old comrades, too, in the ranks of the San Patricios, which is a very strange thing, I think.
And the San Patricios really came to an end as we know them at, the Battle of Churubusco?
Churubusco, which was the bloodiest day of the war. It was just a ferocious fight, and the Mexican Army really handed the U.S. Army some of its worst casualties of the war. And in that battle, I mean, the U.S. soldiers who participated, who fought against the San Patricios, who were holding a fortified convent at Churubusco, they all, as much as they hated the San Patricios, they talked about just how magnificently Riley and his men fought in that battle. Obviously, they were desperate, but this was sort of a theme. Every action that the San Patricios fought in, and they fought in the major battles of the war, they performed unbelievably well. Riley, obviously, had learned his trade well in the British Army.
So as a commander, very, very efficient.
Very efficient.
I think our listeners will be a little bit surprised to find out what happened to the San Patricios after they were captured. Obviously, the notion they were deserters, we have a preconceived notion they were all taken out and strung up. What happened to all of them?
Not all of them. John Riley, obviously the most notorious, the one an American officer wrote, it would be better to release every other one of the deserters captured than to have let Riley escape the noose. Well, Winfield Scott, the American commander, did just that. his nickname was Old Fuss and Feathers, Scott, and he literally lived the Articles of War. He was by the book. He'd been trained as a lawyer earlier in his life, and he was almost incapable of going against the law or against the rules. In Riley's case, he deserted several weeks before the war began. So according to the Articles of War, as Scott emphasized, Riley could not be hanged as a deserter. The worst that could be imposed upon him was 50 lashes with a rawhide whip, and also branding with a cattle brand on the face, the D for deserter. Now, it has to be pointed out, there were plenty of occasions in the U.S. Army over the years where men did die under the lash, so it wasn't that he was getting off easy, but he did escape the noose on a technicality.
And looking at some of the other cases, Scott even went so far as to exonerate completely one of the individuals. Dozens were, as you said, put to the lash or the scourge, and not everyone was executed. So
that's correct. So he did find mitigating circumstances in several of the cases. Again, there were several men, as with Riley, who had deserted before the actual outbreak of war at Palo Alto and Resaca de la Palma. And also, he made allowances for one, a 15-year-old boy, who he said that technically, again, he was right, that he wasn't old enough to sign an enlistment paper without his parents having signed it, so he was let go. And also several other cases like that. He went by the book, although some have argued that the obviously the punishments, the lashings and brandings were harsh. They weren't completely out of line with U.S. Army punishments of the day.
Well, if you will, then, as we come to a close of our interview today, help our listeners remember St. Patrick's Day in a way that will focus on the San Patricios, their contribution to American history and identity. What should we remember about San Patricios?
Well, I think it gets to an issue that's still going on today. Because of nativism and all the religious prejudice and all the anti-foreigner prejudice that was running rampant in the U.S. at that time, for reasons that aren't completely the same as our own era, obviously, but this issue of assimilation as to who is American, who's going to belong, how many do we let in, what are we going to do as more and more come in, these are issues that we're obviously still grappling with today. So in the larger sense, the story of John Riley and his men, at least some of his men, it I believe that it still blazes today in that sense. I really believe that assimilation is the issue here.
Well, Peter, we appreciate your time, and I know that everyone's going to be looking forward to May with the release of The Rogue's March, Peter Stevens' new book.
I hope so, and I really appreciate your having given me the chance to talk about the San Patricios.
Our pleasure to have you on Talking History. Once again, we've been talking with Peter F. Stevens, author of The Rogue's March, The Intriguing Story of the San Patricio Battalion. This week's historical site takes us to the hallowed ground of Antietam Battlefield in Sharpsburg, Maryland, where a new monument dedicated to the Union Army's 1st Regiment, Irish Brigade, was recently erected. The monument, made of two bronze relief structures set into a 20-ton tablet of gray Irish granite, is a tribute to one of the most famous and storied units in American military history. Made up mostly of poor immigrants, the Irish Brigade fought bravely with 71,000 other Union soldiers at Antietam in September of 1862. The monument is the last the government will permit at the site. We have two items to call to your attention as part of our segment, Previews of Coming Attractions. The Past makes it out of the classroom and onto the big screen this month with history-related films due in theaters. The Man in the Iron Mask is designated for release on March 13th. Directed by Bravehearts author Randall Wallace, this adaptation of Alexandre Dumas' novel will star Leonardo DiCaprio in the role of Louis XIV and his imprisoned look-alike. The Smithsonian Museum of American History will open a new exhibit March 19th, Ella Fitzgerald, First Lady of Song. The display, which will continue indefinitely and was funded by a donation by the Fitzgerald Estate, features photos of the famous jazz singer in performance, sheet music of favorite songs, and numerous awards honoring Fitzgerald. One of the more colorful objects on display includes a broken goblet used in a commercial for Memorex audio tapes. The exhibit will also feature audio and video footage of Fitzgerald. And finally, in keeping with our celebration of St. Patrick's Day, we have a special treat for you, poet Eamon Wall. Wall, Irish by birth, now professor of English and director of Creighton University's Irish Summer School, is the author of two widely praised books of poetry, Dykeman 200th Street and Iron Mountain. The title of Wall's piece is An Irish St. Patrick's Remembrance.
In rural Ireland, where I spent a happy childhood, we looked forward to St. Patrick's Day with great excitement because it marked the end of winter. I remember in my hometown of Enniscorthy, County Wexford, often leaning against the walls of buildings for shelter as I walked up Slaney Street towards the Market Square. During January and February, the damp was in my shoes, in my overcoat, in my very bones. Evenings came early. The sight of the sun was a rarity. The blinds in houses were pulled down well before dinner time. But in the weeks before St. Patrick's Day, I'd look up above me and notice that the sun had returned and taken much of the chill out of the air, that the evenings had begun to lengthen, so now it was possible to play hurling on the prom till tea time. The river Slaney was full and fast, and people were ranged all along its banks fishing for trout. The grass was growing again, and soon the farmers would send their cattle into the fields to graze. Tradition had it that the cattle could not be brought out and onto the field till St. Patrick's Day, something which St. Patrick would have appreciated, given the fact that part of his life was given over to tending for animals. The countryside was beginning to become abundant with flowers. Imitating nature, people sensed again that both present and future were full of possibility. The imminent return of St. Patrick had lifted the gloom of winter. In school, we prepared for the St. Patrick's Day Children's Mass to be held in St. Aidan's Cathedral, just above the street from my parents' home. Although we memorized all of our prayers in both English and Irish in school, St. Patrick's Day was special, for the Cathedral Mass itself was said in Irish, and this represented for us an exciting opportunity to show off how good our Irish was. We wore our best clothes, we hadn't looked as clean since Christmas, and wore great sprigs of shamrock attached with safety pins to our jackets and dresses. After Mass, I looked forward to the parade of floats through town, but most of all I looked forward to dinner, the centerpiece of which was Colcannon, a delicious Irish dish of potatoes, parsnips, and onions. At the end of dinner, we gathered around the piano and sung songs which resonated deep with history. Songs of victory and defeat, poverty and salvation, desperation and forgiveness, misunderstanding and accommodation. We understood that for us Irish in Ireland or scattered throughout the world, this was our day. A day is necessary to us as water.
You've been listening to Eamon Wall from Creighton University. That's it for another week of Talking History. Let us hear from you at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or regular mail at Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from Creighton University, this is Robert Hopkins. ¶¶